From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with guitarist Doc Watson. Watson's been called a living national treasure for his virtuoso flat picking and his repertoire of traditional folk and bluegrass tunes. Then we move on to the wrong notes and agonizing rhythms of Jonathan and Darlene Edwards. These two intentionally inept performers are the alter egos of Paul Weston and Joe Stafford. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Chalk Mark in a Rainstorm, the new album from Joni Mitchell. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Milagro Beanfield War, the new movie from actor-turned-director Robert Redford. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Doc Watson is the guitarist who's usually called the single finest flat picker in the country. The only argument you're likely to get about that is from people who don't want to praise his playing at the expense of praising his singing. It's going on 3 decades that Doc Watson has been one of America's preeminent folk and country performers. He's announced that he plans on retiring about a year from now. Throughout much of his career, he performed and toured with his son Merle Watson. Merle was tragically killed in a tractor accident a couple of years ago. Before we meet Doc Watson, let's listen to a selection from his latest album, Portrait.
Waked up this morning feeling so blue. I had an awful dream, babe, all about you. And I'm worried now, 'cause I didn't want that dream to come true. That old dream was awful, so awful to me. Dream that I saw you sitting on his knee. And I'm worried now, 'cause that dream has come true, don't you see? There's no use in lying just 'cause you can. Honey, I just saw you with
that. That's I'm Worried Now from Doc Watson's latest album, Portrait. Doc Watson, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you here. I'd like to ask you first, how come you plan on retiring? And are you retiring from music altogether or just from being on the road?
Just from being on the road. I reckon I'll pick a little dab now and then as long as I live. I was 65 the 3rd of this March. And it's been 26 years on the road, or a little better than will be when I retire. And I reckon the stress of the travel is the hard part, and that's why. It's not the music or the love of good audiences that I'm tired of. The road, I don't know, the stress of travel to me is harder than pulling a crosscut saw. And if you never saw a crosscut saw, you don't know what hard work that is.
I've read you say that if you weren't blind, you don't think you would have ever gone on the road, and I wasn't sure how to interpret that.
I wouldn't have because of exactly what I was talking about. I would rather have a job where I could go home at night. I would have played music, of course. There's no doubt about that because I think you're born with music or whatever talent that comes out front in your blood, as the old-timers used to say, and you just couldn't help but pick first time a guitar came along. You'd learn it. But it would have been a hobby. I'd like to have been a carpenter or an electrician or something, kind of work like that, or a mechanic if I could see. I can do rough carpenter work anyway.
But so you think you would have played, but you wouldn't have toured as much.
Right.
Now, you grew up in North Carolina, where you still live, and I'm just always amazed at the number of families that perform in the South, and I think there were several performers in your family.
Nobody performed professionally but me. My father-in-law, Gaither Carlton, went on the road a trip or two with Merle and I in the early days. And my oldest brother made a couple of trips, Arnold. But they really didn't get into it professionally. And my father-in-law, he hated the road.
Right.
He loved his fiddle. But Lord, he got homesick when he was away from home.
Didn't your father make the first banjo that you played?
Yeah, he did. That was in the summer of 1934. Made my first little stringed instrument. I had a harmonica before that. But Dad showed me a few of the old-time Fralin or Clawhammer banjo-style tunes, and one day he brought it to me and put it in my hands and said, "Son, I want you to learn to play this thing real well. Some of these days we'll get you a better one." He said, "Might help you get through the world."
And what was it like for you the first time you got the banjo into your hands? What did you do with it?
I really don't remember. I remember how I felt, but I don't remember hardly what it was like learning the first tunes. It was kind of hard for Dad to show me because I couldn't see his hands, and it was a little tough. But he finally got across to me how to do the licks on the banjo and how to note the thing. And I could figure out where the notes were because it was fretless, and you could slide along with your fingers, and finally you come to the right one, you know, and you found out how to get there without missing them.
So you were really pretty self-taught.
For the most part, yes, I was. The guitar, absolutely, I was self-taught.
How did you get your first guitar?
By pulling the crosscut saw that I mentioned at first. One spring, my dad told my youngest brother and I, "Boys, if you'll cut all those small dead chestnuts down along the road and around the edge of the field there, you can sell it for pulpwood to the tannery." And we went at it, and we cut a couple of big truckloads. It didn't make us a mint of money, but it made me enough to buy me a good little guitar I thought it was good at the time, from Sears Roebuck. And my younger brother ordered him a suit of clothes.
Now, considering that your early instruments were homemade banjos and a mail-order guitar, did you ever get really obsessed with the quality of instruments that you were playing? Some musicians just play what they have, and others get really obsessed with having instruments that are just right for them or custom-made for them.
I was fairly contented with what I had. I never had had my hands on a good guitar back in those days, and didn't for years. The first good guitar that I got hold of that I would have considered much better than my mail-order box was a Martin guitar that Richard Green used to have a little music store under his, he had a boarding house or an inn there in Boone. And I went in there one day with that little mail order thing, and he said, "Why don't you let me help you get you a good guitar?" And I said, "Gosh, it costs too much." And he said, "I'll tell you what I can do. I can get you a good Martin D18 that will be a price that you can afford, and I'll take the payments down to $5 a month." And I couldn't beat that. I paid it off quicker than that, but I couldn't beat that with a stick. And at that time, I was playing at the little fruit stand and a little bean market they had in Boone, and making me a few shekels on Saturday, having a good time of picking, and I paid for the guitar that summer. He got me that thing at his cost, and it cost $90, and I paid for it. Oh, Lord, I was proud of that guitar. But in all truth, compared to my guitar now, it was like fretting a fence. It was really hard to play.
Well, I guess it's almost good in a way to get used to something like that, because it makes it seem so much easier when you get a good guitar.
Oh, it really does. And when I got into the folk revival in the 60s, I ran into people who could set a guitar action up to where you could play it, and I came on to another Martin along about that time. Played a Gibson at first on the road, borrowed. And then I came into another Martin, and the action was brought down to where you could play it.
My guest is Doc Watson. You know, I'm glad you brought up the folk revival. It was really during the folk revival that you started to become nationally known. I think you'd been playing dances and playing
played
in your
rockabilly
area.
Music through the 50s and played an electric guitar, Les Paul.
Well, see, this really interests me. You were playing rockabilly and an electric guitar.
Mm-hmm. Rockabilly and old pop standards with an old boy named Jack Williams. Jack had a little group together, and when he heard me pick, he said, "Buddy, I want you to pick with me."
Now, the way I understand it, Ralph Rinsler, who was working at the Smithsonian Institute, came down looking for traditional Southern musicians, came down your way and heard about you.
He was looking for Clarence Ashley and found him, Clarence Tom Ashley. And I had played music with Tom on a few land sales and a few little shows here and there. And Ralph came over, and when he heard me, he persuaded me over my better judgment at the time that I had something to offer in the way of entertainment in the folk revival. So I jumped in there with both hands, I reckon, thinking, well, if I fail at it, it won't mean I didn't try. So I'm here, and Ralph was a member of the Greenbrier Boys at the time.
Now, you had been playing, electric guitar. Did you have to switch over to acoustic in order to make it in the folk revival?
Yeah, switch back to the acoustic. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, Lord, if you'd have took an electric guitar on the stage on some of those festivals, they would have booed you off the stage if you were supposed to be. They used to call me ethnic until they found out I knew a few other tunes other than the old hand-me-downs, you know, the ballads and the good old tunes that I cut my teeth on. I think I really shocked some people in some of the clubs when I got my foot in the door. Ralph says, now, when you get your foot in the door, you can expand out and play a little of the other music that you've played over the years, but stick strictly to traditional music, the good old ethnic stuff, till you get started. So that's what I did. I kind of deceived people a little, you know.
Well, you must have found it kind of funny, maybe a little bit absurd, that people were so stuck on authenticity, whatever that means.
No, not really. It was surprising, but very pleasantly, because I happen to love old-time music, ballads, the good down-home blues, those kind of things. I happen to love those actually better than any other kind of music. I love the other stuff, a lot of it, very much, and can listen to it contentedly. Even some of the easy listening music I like. But when it come right down to it, I can sit half a day and listen to good folk music. I mean, the real authentic stuff.
Well, I want to play something that was recorded by Ralph Rinsler. Ralph Rinsler recorded it. You were performing.
In my living room. In my living room, yeah.
And this is a recording. It was from the early 1960s. And this is Everyday Dirt. Tell us a little bit about the song before we hear this.
A fellow, David McCarn, was living in a mill town, Gastonia, North Carolina. And he heard about some recording sessions going on down, I think it was Knoxville, Tennessee. And he probably slung his guitar over his back, knowing how those poor old boys fared. He and a fella, Howard, I've forgotten his given name, went over to Knoxville and recorded a bunch of things. And Everyday Dirt was one of the songs that happened in our little record collection when I was a little boy. And those words are just, oh, you know, they're automatic. I didn't even have to think about the lyrics on that. I did have to work at picking it. I learned it off the old 78 record that McCarn recorded.
Okay, so from the early 1960s, this is my guest, Doc Watson.
Now John come home, all in a wonder. He rattled at the door just like thunder. Who is that, Mr. Henley cried? 'Tis my husband you must hire. Then John sat down by the fireside weeping, and up that chimney he got to peeping. There he saw that poor old soul setting up a straddle of the pot rack pole. John built on a rousing fire just to suit his own desire. His wife got out with a free good will. Don't do that for the man you'll kill. Then John drenched up and down he fetched him like a coon. When a dog had catched him, he blacked his eyes and then did better. Kicked him out right on his setter. Then his wife, she crawled in under the bed, and he pulled her out by the hair of the head. And when I'm gone, remember then, he kicked her where the chinches had been.
Recorded in the early 1960s, that's my guest, Doug Watson. How did you learn how to pick that way? We found out that you were self-taught, but it seems like it would be really hard to teach yourself an intricate style like
that. Well, by listening to the old records, you could hear after you got familiarized with the instrument, you could hear what strings they were hitting on and what chord they were playing in just by the sound. After all, music is sound. And I think if anybody learns the guitar properly, they shouldn't, as soon as they can get to where they can't, stop looking at the neck and play without doing that, unless it's something really hard that you're getting into. You know, you need to memorize the distances and the jumps on the neck. As I said, music is sound, and I could tell what the guy was doing, the little slide licks on there where he goes down to a certain note and then jumps back up there. All the chords are sound to me. It's like you reading something once I was familiar with the guitar.
Once you put down the electric guitar for the acoustic guitar, how often did you pick up the electric guitar again?
Very seldom. After I got into folk music and into the revival and began to play a little jobs at coffee houses. I don't I seldom, if ever, picked up the electric guitar.
Do you miss it at all?
No, not. I love a good electric guitar. That one wasn't all that good. It was a second, actually. It was a Les Paul Gibson. But it really was a second. The neck on it wasn't all that good. I thought it was a great thing when I first got a hold of it. It had a beautiful sound. But there's some that are so much better now than it was, sound-wise, you know, and as to play, that I picked up a Chet Atkins model electric Gibson the other day, beautiful hollow body. Oh, Lord, now I was interested in that thing.
My guest is Doc Watson, who is one of America's foremost folk and country performers. We're going to talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced at WHYY Radio in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Guitarist and singer Doc Watson is my guest. Once you went on the road during the folk revival, now you weren't used to traveling. There must have been a lot you learned had to learn how to do. Did you have a business manager to help you out with bookings? And
Ralph Rensler did the bookings between he and Manny Greenhill of Folklore Productions. But Ralph traveled a lot with me, and if he didn't, when I went go to New York to work in the city, I came by Trailways bus. Someone would always meet me at the Port Authority and take me over to Ralph's apartment. I worked lots of times. I'd work at Gertie's Folk City a week or 2 weeks at a time, doing either opening act or just playing the job straight there. It was scary. I was as green as a green apple as far as the city. Country boy, really.
Oh, yeah, sure.
As the old-timers used to say, a hayseed for sure. But I... The scary part finally, and the adventure finally got over with, and that road, it became a job.
Yeah,
music, a good audience, I love.
I think there's always clubs who, not many, but there's always some clubs willing to take advantage of a performer. And I would guess that someone who was blind was a more likely target if they didn't have people who were watching out for them. Would you ever have any problems with that?
I was glad when my son Merle started on the road with me, because if we went to a place and they didn't treat me too good, Dad, we won't come back here no more. And that was the end of it. I'd tell Mr. Greenhill, don't book that anymore. That was the end of it. We didn't hit too many places that they weren't really decent to us, but once in a great while there, of course, I won't call any names because we're on nationwide radio. But we were in a few places where they treated you like pieces of used equipment. And that was the end of playing there. We just didn't do it again. That's the best thing you can do, you know, is not tolerate that. Just move away.
You mentioned your son Merle. Did you teach him how to play guitar?
No. Merle didn't show any interest in the guitar until he was 15. I was on my first concert tour, a little solo concert tour that spring, and about midways of it, Ralph called me and said, Doc, I've got some good news. And I said, well, lay it on me. And he said, Merle has started playing the guitar. His mother, Rosalie, started him on the guitar. She taught him his first chords and showed him how to play them and a little bit about timing, and he just took it and went with it. And we met John Hurt for the first time that same summer. We went to the Berkeley Folk Festival, and Merle played backup guitar for me. He'd only been playing about 3 months, and he played backup guitar on the stage. And when we met John Hurt, Merle was enthralled by John's finger style on the guitar, and he took that and added a few little notions of his own, and that's where Merle's finger style came from.
So he never felt that he had to work hard to differentiate his style from your style?
Merle, he once in a while he'd ask me for some pointers on a melody to a song or something, but Merle played his very own thing on the guitar. I don't think he even ever asked me how to hold the pick. He probably looked at the way I held it. But I never really sat down and taught him how you get this note or that note. I just played a song and sang it, and he jumped in there and learned the lead to it, like Summertime, for instance. I had heard a version of that, and I said, Merle, what do you think about learning this? And I played the thing about halfway through, and he said, gosh, I don't know, that sounds like it'd be hard. And so help me, in 5 minutes, he could play the lead to it. And when we did the recording, I'll say this about it, and then we'll move on. When we did the recording, the producer, Jack Clement, came running through and said, boys, don't touch it. It was the first take. He says, that one's the way it should be. And Merle said, well, it was spontaneous. And he said, Dad, I'll have to go back and memorize what I did. Those things happen in the studio a lot of time. You know, after you learn a song, you'll hear notes that you just reach for, and they're there. And you play things that you hadn't played before.
Yeah, I've noticed with a lot of musicians that they meet all these people who've memorized their licks and they have no idea what they played. They were just being spontaneous, and everybody else goes and memorizes it. When your son Merle died, was it hard for you to go back on the road afterwards?
If you'll pardon a little intimacy here, I'll tell you something that happened or I wouldn't have. Between the time he was killed and his funeral, I dreamed I was in a dark desert, and it was so hot you couldn't breathe. And the sand was pulling me down like if you were in quicksand. And that big, strong hand reached back and said, come on, Dad, you can make it. And he brought me, led me out to where it was cool, but there was a cool, sunny, but there was a cool breeze. And I waked up and I thought, well, I'll try. And I took up the last job on that particular tour that we'd canceled. And my friend Jack Lawrence had been working some while Merle was off the road with us for quite a while, and Jack stayed on as the other guitarist. And I'm kind of glad I did. If I had stayed off the road a month, I never would have come back. It was so hard, you know. You couldn't know, Terry, but it was really hard to go back out there without him.
But I guess that dream kind of gave you permission in a way to do it.
I believe it was godsend, I think, mm-hmm, the dream mm-hmm. was.
I want to play a record with you and Merle performing, and this is from an album you recorded together, the Doc Watson, Merle Watson guitar album, and this is Talking to Casey, and Merle Watson is featured on slide guitar. Doc and Merle Watson. Doc Watson is my guest. You know, I've been using the word virtuoso today, and I would guess that one of the problems of being a virtuoso is that people want to hear you play fast all the time, to hear you really, you know, do the most difficult stuff that you can do.
Well, yeah, a lot of people do get into that, but usually if you have a big audience, you can't really take requests from the when you're on stage, so you just program your set, and you season it with enough of that to keep the people who love the flashy things satisfied and kind of do a sensible set. I don't mind it if people like to hear the flat picking, and it does give you a boost to get a lot of yells and whistles and screams from the audience, you know, but I love the good solid music too. And most of the audience do, really. When it comes right down to it, they like to hear you, the whole scope of the thing. Being accused of being a virtuoso doesn't bother me as bad as people trying to put me on a pedestal, especially when they're my own age.
What do you mean by putting you on a pedestal?
Well, they act like you're a god or something, you know. Lord, I'm just people. Like everybody else, I do play the guitar, but I had to work awful hard at it to learn what I know.
Why is this more difficult for you to cope with if it's someone your own age saying that?
Because they know better. They should know that I'm people. if it's a high school age or a younger boy or a girl, I let them get away with it. You know, you let them down easy. You don't agree to it, but you let them down easy. But you think somebody up Doc Watson's age would know that Doc's just a normal human being that likes to pick the guitar. He's not a celebrity. I never have felt like I am, you know. And I don't know how to act like a politician.
You've told us that you plan on retiring, probably around a year from now. So what are you going to do when you retire?
I'll play on weekends some with some square dance group that I know of around home and pick a little around home. But I think as for the road, once I retire, I think I'll stay out of it, because if I start dabbling, the first thing I know, I'll be right back out there in the same old drive. And the stress of travel is what I'd like to get away from. To me, it's harder than physical hard work.
Now, what about studio work? Would you ever want to do any of that?
I don't know. I'm going to let that one hang as a question mark. I won't say no or yes.
Can I ask you a question that I hope you don't mind me asking? And if you do, don't answer it. A lot of performers who are blind wear dark glasses when they perform, and that's something you've never done.
I don't know why. I always hated, used to have had a good bit of light perception. Doesn't bother me now because most of it's gone. But the reflection off sunglasses, you know how it'll come in on the sides. I guess they make them now, it won't do it. But boy, they used to try to get me to wear them. I reckon they didn't like the way my eyes looked. A lot of people would say you ought to wear sunglasses. I hated them. I wouldn't do it. And I just never have worn them. I don't know if the blind that wear them, their eyes look really abnormal or what. I don't know. I never did care to wear them, just didn't do it.
Right.
No particular reason except what I told you.
Yeah, well, I could certainly understand that. I mean, I don't understand why they need to be worn by... I guess it's preference, just whether you want to wear
suppose,
them or not.
I suppose, yeah.
One last thing. You know, there's a really nice recording on the album that we heard earlier from the early 60s of you and your wife singing together. Does she still sing? Do you ever sing together?
She doesn't sing anymore or play anymore. The tragedy of losing Merle, Terry, has just about undone her. She does the office work there at home, but she's not Rosalie anymore. Bless her little heart. I don't know, sometimes I just want to cry. And, you know, especially when I'm away from her, I do, when I think about it. I try not to and try to encourage her what I can, but it's been tough on her, and she can't seem to get over the loss. The grief really has her yet.
Yeah, I can understand. Well, you'll be able to spend more time together when you retire. Oh, I regret we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for coming, for talking with us about music, and thank you very much. And I hope you have a good continuing year on the road.
I'll guarantee you it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much. My guest has been Doc Watson, and if you'd like to hear some of his recent music, his latest album is called Portrait. It's on Sugar Hill Records. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with reporter Nicholas Daniloff, who's written a new book about the time he was arrested and charged with spying in the Soviet Union. I hope you can join us.
Along about 1825, I left Tennessee very much alive, and I never would have got through the Arkansas mud if I had.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, if you're tone deaf and have no sense of rhythm, take heart. Jonathan and Darlene Edwards probably sound worse than you do. Jonathan and Darlene are the comic alter egos of singer Joe Stafford and pianist and arranger Paul Weston. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album from Joni Mitchell. It's called Chalkmark in a Rainstorm, and it features vocals by Peter Gabriel, Billy Idol, and Willie Nelson. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the movie adaptation of John Nichols' novel, The Milagro Beanfield War. It's directed by Robert Redford. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Lori Waffenschmidt. The signing of a ceasefire accord in Nicaragua made banner headlines in the pro-Sandinista press in Managua today. The agreement calls for a 60-day truce and a temporary halt to outside military aid to the Contras. More from Charles Castaldi in Managua.
There is a level of optimism here that cuts through the deep ideological differences that have come to divide Nicaraguans. Eric Ramirez, leader of the Social Christian Party, said he was upbeat about the future of the accords. He said that much work still needed to be done on the specifics of the ceasefire, but he thought there was a good chance the war would end soon. The accord put in place a ceasefire that will go on at least until the end of May. A high-level Contra delegation will come to Managua in 2 weeks to try to finalize a permanent ceasefire. As part of the accord, the Nicaraguan government has pledged to release 100 political prisoners this Sunday. The remainder will be released during the course of the ceasefire. For National Public Radio, this is Charles Castaldi in Managua.
The Reagan administration is reacting cautiously to the Nicaraguan ceasefire agreement. Details from NPR's Richard Gonzalez.
White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater says the ceasefire agreement merely opens the gate on a long road to peace, and he says the White House is still studying the plan. Reaction at the State Department was a bit more positive. Secretary of State George Shultz says the agreement is a product of the determination and sacrifice of the Contras.
Their strength and perseverance have created this opportunity for peace and freedom. We consider this agreement to be an important step forward.
Shultz called on Congress to provide immediate non-lethal aid to the Contras. House Speaker Jim Wright says he hopes such aid could be passed before the Easter recess. He added that the administration and Congress, who have been locked in a bitter battle over Contra aid, should also bury the hatchet and reach a reconciliation like the Nicaraguans apparently have accomplished. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
The Honduran government says it filed a protest today with Nicaragua over a reported border crossing by Nicaraguan troops on Tuesday. Nicaragua has denied the report. The alleged invasion took place in the same region where Sandinista forces fought with Contra rebels last week. The Pentagon said today the United States has moved 250 more military police into Panama this week to help protect American people and property. The military has flown in 670 extra security personnel since the beginning of civil unrest aimed at forcing the ouster of military leader Manuel Noriega. A leading political opposition figure returned from exile today. Christian Democratic Party leader Ricardo Arias Calderon told a cheering crowd at the airport in Panama City, "We have but one objective, to get rid of Manuel Noriega." Israeli jets bombed Palestinian bases in southern Lebanon today. The strikes were the second in 24 hours. According to Israeli radio, the targets were supply bases for Palestinian groups based near the southern Lebanese city of Sidon. Also today, two Palestinians were killed in clashes with Israeli soldiers. NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
Two Palestinians were killed in the refugee camp of Balata today in the northern part of the occupied territories. According to Israeli radio, there were clashes in the camp today when young demonstrators attacked an army patrol with stones and metal bars. Three border police were injured. Haim Bar Lev, Israel's minister of police, announced the arrest today of Palestinian activists accused of writing leaflets directing the demonstrations. In the almost 4 months of Palestinian protests, numbered leaflets have been distributed with instructions for commercial strikes, demonstration days, plus calls for campaigns of civil disobedience. In Jerusalem, this is Deborah Amos.
Fears over inflation sent stock prices sharply lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped almost 44 points to close at 2023.87. Declines led advances 8-1 on volume of 186 million shares. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Joni Mitchell has a new album called Chalk Mark in a Rainstorm, and rock critic Ken Tucker has a review. The album is Mitchell's first since Dog Eat Dog in 1985. For this new one, she's assembled a well-known group of musicians, including Willie Nelson, Don Henley from the Eagles, Tom Petty, and Peter Gabriel.
I'm going to take you to my secret place, says Joni Mitchell at the start of her new album. It's a song in which the narrator is speaking to a new lover, making romantic promises, but lots of listeners may take it as something else.
People talk to tell you something, or to take up space. Guess I'm only talking to be talking to. I don't talk much to anyone, but you're a special case for my special place. My special place.
The song's ethereal melodiousness and first-person intimacy hark back to Mitchell's trilogy of self-revelation, the albums Blue, For the Roses, and Court and Spark. These records, released between 1971 and 1974, represent the last time Mitchell was speaking private thoughts to a vast public. For much of the past decade, Mitchell has indulged her interest in jazz and jazz-influenced pop. In the process, she's alienated most of the audience that had made her a star. Chalk Mark in a Rainstorm, however, is the best sort of comeback. It reestablishes her connection to pop music without denying the unpopular music in which she had placed her faith. That's Dancin' Clown, a song that illustrates one of Joni Mitchell's stylistic experiments on this album. Many of the songs here tend to be narratives with dialogue, lots of he saids and she saids. Wherever possible, Mitchell has other vocalists singing her speeches. For example, that was the pouty punk star Billy Idol, yowling out the part of the bully boyfriend in Dancin' Clown. But the most striking example of this strategy occurs a little later in the album, when Mitchell takes the old cowboy song Cool Water, rewrites it in Joni Mitchell harmonics, and casts Willie Nelson as Dan, the old cowpoke whose spirit yearns for cool, clear water. Taking a 1936 song made famous by Roy Rogers and making it her own is inspired eccentricity, one of those leaps of artistic intuition that Mitchell encourages in her music. When they work, as I think that one does, it's a beautiful shock. When it doesn't, the music seems vaguely embarrassed for itself. There are a couple of audacious clinkers on Chalk Mark in a Rainstorm, such as one called The Tea Leaf Prophecy, Lay Down Your Arms, which is a sort of pie-eyed anti-war screed. Then there's Lakota, in which Mitchell assumes the role of an American Indian. Lakota, looking at money, man. In Lakota, Mitchell's sympathy with Native Americans can easily become confused with self-righteousness. The solemn drone of the music comes to sound ponderous. Most of the time, however, Chalk Mark in a Rainstorm suggests why Joni Mitchell was once considered the most innovative of all the singer-songwriters that emerged in the late 60s. These days, she has mastered the sound of synthesizers and drum machines and merges them with her own vocal tracks to create revelatory, often entrancing music.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
I took a house by the water, took a man on a mountainside. Pretty house by the water, lovely lather by the waterside. Last time I saw that man, he hung down his head and cried. Corina, Corina, do you have to go?
This is Fresh Air.
Saturday dance.
What began as a party gag led to four of some of the most inept-sounding recordings ever made, not to mention a Grammy Award for Jonathan and Darlene Edwards. They're the alter egos of singer Joe Stafford and her husband, pianist and arranger Paul Weston. Weston and Stafford have plenty of impressive credentials under their own names. After her days as a member of the Pied Pipers, singing with Tommy Dorsey and Frank Sinatra, Stafford recorded hit after hit in the 1940s and 50s, culminating in Columbia Records presenting her the Diamond Award as the first recording artist to sell 25 million records. Paul Weston has had a long and successful career as an arranger and bandleader and was the founding president of the National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences. The two have their own record label, Corinthian Records, and they've just reissued on compact disc Paul Weston and Joe Stafford recordings, along with Jonathan and Darlene's greatest hits.
Been invited on days, might have gone, but what for? Awfully different without you. Don't get around much anymore.
Joe Stafford, when you're singing as Darlene, do you sway back and forth with your eyes closed?
In my mind, I do. In my mind, I do, wearing a hat and white gloves at all times, even in the recording studio.
One of the songs that you do is Alabama Bound, and it features you singing accompanied by a chorus of overzealous, overenthusiastic male singers.
Well, we did that as a sort of a put-on of the Mitch Miller sing-along. And the idea with these singers that backed us up, they were some of the best singers in town. And we just told them to be, you know, they sang very well, but a little, maybe a teensy bit overenthusiastic. And but actually, they did their parts quite nicely, I thought.
I thought this record might be somehow a tribute to Mitch Miller. Now, this is interesting. You'd both worked at Columbia Records, where Mitch Miller was the head of Artists and Repertoire.
Mm-hmm.
How did he take to this little tribute?
We just never asked him.
And we've never heard.
What was the first time that you performed together as Jonathan and Darlene?
I would play piano at parties, you know, after Johnny Green and David Rose and everyone else had finished playing well.
I would just play for the fun of it and play like Jonathan. And Joe became Darlene at the end of record sessions when Mitch Miller would send us out some junk to record and the guys in the band, and Joe hated it so much that she would do it as Darlene at the end of the session.
Just as a kind of a way to put down the song that we all hated anyway, just for fun.
So I can see how this tribute to Mitch Miller might have had a real special magic for you under the circumstances.
Boy, you hit it right on the button.
Joe Stafford, let me ask you a few questions about your real self. You had many very popular records during the Second World War. How were you choosing your material then? Did you especially look for records that you thought could really have an extra special meaning to people who were separated during the war?
Well, I think the songs that the songwriters wrote took care of that. You know, there were some great songwriters then, and I think that the times during the war years, I mean, the time sort of dictated the content of the material, and it was there, ready made.
What kind of stories did you hear from people during the war and then after the war about what your songs meant to them, the kind of sentimental meaning the songs took on?
Oh, a great deal. As a matter of fact, I still get them. I still get letters saying, I first heard you at such and such a time during the war in the East, someplace in the Pacific or flying over Europe. I still get them. And yes, many of the songs meant a great deal to them and to me. And I was often like the go-between between this fellow and his girl. And what I was singing was, quote, their song, unquote.
Paul Weston, I have a couple of questions for you.
Okay.
When you started to arrange for Capitol Records, you came up with a new sound that got the name of mood music. Describe the sound that you were working with.
Well, what I did in my mood music was to take and add strings to a dance band sound. I, you know, deeply resented later when it deteriorated into what they call elevator music, because we had great soloists, Eddie Miller and Matty Matlock and Ziggy Elman, on all those albums, and we, you know, kept a jazz feel. I enjoyed it because we were the first, at that time only Castellanets was doing a similar kind of music, but more on a classical scale. And it was fun starting a trend.
When rock and roll started making it onto the charts in the 1950s, did that make things difficult for you both?
Well, at that time, I was doing television, and a lot of television, besides the recording. And there was a kind of an attempt to get me connected and to try and do some of that material. And it wouldn't work. I couldn't do it. And but my career continued on in television, which at that point was not that much affected by rock and roll. The music on television stayed pretty much the same for a number of years.
I was doing television then as a conductor. And, of course, we had, in the early days, they would have these rock artists as guests. And I did a show with The Doors with Jim Morrison. And
one.
And I did a show with the Mamas and the Papas, but they were called the Big Three at that time.
You know, Joe Stafford, you had a hit of You Belong to Me, and then the Dupree's had a rock and roll version of that years later. I was wondering what you thought of that when that made it onto the charts.
I don't think... I wasn't even aware of that until some kind of a seminar we had in which some young A&R man...
Snuffy Garrett.
Brought it up as a... He was using it as some kind of an example of a style that these people could do if they wanted to, and he made a big speech about this song, You Belong to Me, not realizing that I, who was sitting next to him, had been the first one to record it and had a tremendous hit from it. He didn't even know it.
And he said this song was recorded so many years ago by somebody, you know, as old, you know, and Joe's sitting there next to him.
See the pyramids along the Nile. Watch the sunrise on a tropic isle. Just
record anymore, either of you?
No, I don't know, huh?
No, the last thing we did was the Jonathan Darlene album, Darlene Remembers Duke and Jonathan Plays Fats, which we did about 5 years ago.
Oh, does Darlene continue to perform long after Joe Stafford had retired?
Now, why is that?
It's easier.
It's a lot easier, and you don't have to worry about the perfection I always tried to come up with.
Okay, well, you guys really know how to swing.
Beautiful.
You must take the A train to go to Sugar Hill way up in Harlem. If you miss the A train,
Joe Stafford and Paul Weston spoke to us from the NPR Bureau in Los Angeles. Jonathan and Darlene Edwards' Greatest Hits is on the Corinthian record label. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Robert Siegel and see what they have planned. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What story is he following?
Well, in addition to the news, we have interviews on the program today with Alejandro Bendaña of the Nicaraguan Foreign Ministry about the agreement reached last night. Also with Noam Chomsky about U.S. foreign policy as it pertains to Central America, Panama especially. And also with Stan Levchenko, who is a KGB defector who came over to the U.S. about 8 years ago about the KGB in Japan restrict. Now, I want to ask a totally impartial passerby whether he would listen to this program, sir.
It sounds like a terrific program and certainly worth waiting up for.
Know who that is?
Yeah. Hi, Scott.
Hello, Terry.
Scott Simon will listen to this program, and we hope you will, too.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of The Milagro Beanfield War, directed by Robert Redford. It's the second time Redford has stepped behind the camera to direct. The first was Ordinary People, which won him an Academy Award in 1980. The new film is based on the 1974 novel The Milagro Beanfield War by John Nichols.
Whimsy is not one of my favorite cinematic moods, and The Milagro Beanfield War, unfortunately, is suffused with it. There are dancing caballeros who turn out to be angels. There are loopy old duffers who spout precious wisdom. There's an obstreperous pig who's good for a surefire laugh. There are rainbows served up with nearly every spectacular sunset, and small miracles that forestall misfortune while jolly mandolins ping. And even though the setting, a dried-up New Mexican village called Milagro, is the kind of place that ought to be embittered by eons of hardship and neglect, everyone in it is as perky and lovable as tamale pie. It's that kind of movie. The story's a very pure example of the way Hollywood keeps finding new instances of oppression so it can show us how the little people overcome them. In this case, Milagro is being threatened by rich land developers. They want to turn the region into a glitzy resort. They're hogging the area's water, and they don't take it lightly when Joe Mondragon, played by Chick Venera, decides to irrigate his desolate bean field with some of it. Pretty soon, the whole decrepit town is lined up behind him, including a feisty female mechanic, played by Sonia Braga, a washed-up activist lawyer, played by John Hurd, and even a visiting sociologist, played by Daniel Stern. He gives the movie's most charming performance. Here, for instance, is Stern trying to make himself at home with the region's folkways over a cup of tea with Milagro's oldest denizen.
What does Milagro mean?
Miracle. Like the town.
Oh, thank you. Oh, this looks good. What is it?
Lisa Tail Tea.
Oh, been in the family for generations, I bet.
No, I found it on the highway this morning.
What was that little statue I saw out there on the altar?
St. Jude pulled me through 6 operations. I would belong dead, except for him.
Really? Well, how did he do that?
He's a saint.
It's a funny thing about that scene. Nothing could be more nauseously whimsical, and yet, somehow the thing works. In fact, throughout this movie, you never notice that the stuff you're swallowing is syrup until you're on to the next scene. That perhaps sums up director Robert Redford's gift. His touch is very light, very quick and ironic, more reminiscent of Truffaut than of, say, Frank Capra. Redford is not a terrific director of narrative. He can't quite tell a story clearly, and he throws away his climaxes. None of the scenes that are supposed to produce tension really do. But in this movie, that failing proves a benefit, and it allows us to concentrate on what Redford's really good at, directing actors. He can't do much with bland performers like Julie Carmen as Mondragon's wife, and he's wasted poor Melanie Griffith in a bimbo role far beneath her considerable talents. But he's brought Reuben Blades to life for the first time on screen, as the town's laid-back sheriff. And when he has a really terrific actor on hand, he just lets him rip, which is why Christopher Walken, as the bad guy's evil henchman, and James Gammon, as another henchman only nicer, absolutely shine. And an old pro like M. Emmett Walsh, as the governor, can make his few tiny seconds of screen time seem worth sitting through the whole movie for. The Milagro-Beanfield War is pokey, but it grows more likable by the minute. By the end, I found I wasn't even wincing at that crowd-pleasing pig.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time I'll talk with Jean-Claude Lauzon, the French-Canadian film director whose first feature film, Night Zoo, just swept the Janies. Those are the Canadian Academy Awards. Also, Ken Tucker will review the Basil Rathbone Sherlock Holmes movies now available on home video. And Mac Rebenack, who also goes by the name Dr. John, will pay tribute to Hoagy Carmichael in the next edition of his performance series. So I hope you can join us. And we'd love to hear from you. Drop us a line at Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independent Small West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independent Small West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Ed Doherty, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Lisa Bruton and Warren Kozak. Our engineer is Orji Vablaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.